and especially a warm welcome if it's your first time with us and you don't normally go to Christian things. And I was chatting to someone beforehand who was saying, I'm open to religion. I'm not sure if I'm religious. I just came along because I'm interested. Isn't that awesome? And we really do want to. We had a similar person come to a Tuesday lunchtime event we just did. And if you missed that, that will be up on the website shortly. And the same thing. They were just saying, they asked a question at the end of the session. They'll be getting questions tonight, and you can SMS those through. And they just raised their hand and said, oh, look, I'm not really religious, but I'm just interested, and here's my question. Isn't that great? So we're really keen for that. We run these events for that very reason, so that not only those who are very religious, but also those who aren't, and those who don't know, but do like tacos, to be able to come and investigate things. So it's really brilliant to have you here. Can I just underline, along with the advertisement that was already said, that Christianity 1A is an excellent, informal, discussion-based opportunity to read the Bible for yourself, look at it for yourself, debate, ask questions, discuss, and we organise that. Basically, we ask for expressions of interest, and then we try to find a time that's convenient and a place that's convenient. So if you're open to maybe investigating Christianity in a kind of informal question and answer discussion debate format, there's iPads up the back, you can express interest, or you could talk to myself or one of the many Jordans, and anyone you see up here, you could say, hey, can you point me in the direction of someone who could get me involved in one of those 1A groups. They really are a great time, and so it's like a book club, except reading the Bible. A little bit of a content warning for tonight. That tonight we are looking at a series of wars through the Middle Ages, and so there will be some fairly graphic descriptions of war, violence, torture, and even sexual violence. And so just a heads up on that. And if at any point you just feel like it's just a bit a bit much, we sort of understand it's a bit of an overload for a Thursday night. But be warned. That being said, let's dive in. The Crusades is a pretty common question to get as a Christian. You're in a conversation, in a discussion, maybe in a formal kind of question and answer event or at a party, and the topic of religion comes up. What about the Crusades? Maybe it says something like, you Christian, how dare you tell society how it should conduct itself? What about the Crusades? When you guys had control, look how you did things. Or maybe, how dare you make any negative comment about an Islamic group? What about the Crusades? You guys have been violent too. You're just as bad. And in fact, speaking of Islamic groups, it's quite common for people from a Muslim background to say, what about the Crusades? The reason for the anger, the resentment, and the instability in the Middle East finds its roots back in these unwelcome, barbaric European invasions in the Middle Ages. What about the Crusades? But what about the Crusades? Do you know much about them? Really? What do you know? I know before I began preparing for this, I knew very little. We did a little promo survey in July at the start of semester, and it was mainly promotional, but it was a little quiz where people could have a go at their trivial, you know, quiz night knowledge about Christian history. And we gave a multiple choice, so it was easy, right? How many Crusades were there? 2, 5, 7, or 9? We surveyed 362 people at UTAS, and 76% of people got it wrong. So at least three quarters of us don't know. And given that one of the answers, 5, got absolutely no responses, it wasn't even that just people got a statistically 1 in 4 answer right. But look, that's an unfair example. I mean, factoids. Who knows factoids? Just quiz nerds. You don't have to know the exact number of something to know about something. Often knowledge is about the vibe, right? But even then, if we drill down into more substantial information than just how many there were, what do you know about the Crusades? The people involved, the reasons for it, the events? I expect, apart from perhaps someone who's a devout Muslim, a devout history geek, and maybe a devout militant atheist, probably we know hardly anything. So let's learn together, shall we? I've been learning in the process of researching for tonight's session. Let's learn together as we think about these things. And maybe let's, as we go, be like the website PolitiFact. And let's fact check. Let's see the stories we think we know about the Crusades, or the vibe we've gotten about it. What's true, as the fact checker goes? What's true? What's mostly true? What's mostly false? What's false? And what's liar, liar, pants on fire? Let's have a go at this together. There's three kind of headings I want to approach these wars, these Middle Ages European wars into Palestine. I want to look at it kind of from three angles that kind of build on each other. So firstly, and the longest section is first, we're going to look at the question of, were the Crusades just wars? Were they justified wars? Yeah, and we'll unpack that first, and that will take the most time. And then secondly, we'll consider the fact that, were they legitimately holy wars? Not just justifiable wars, but religious wars. Was that right that they were religious wars? And then the final point is really by way of beginning to think about its relevance for us today, by reflecting on Muslim criticisms of the Crusades, secular criticisms of the Crusades, and Christian reflections on the Crusades. Were they justified? Were they holy? And what can we learn about that today? So, were they justified? Were they just wars, these medieval wars? Well, to understand these wars, we have to understand the social, the historical, the geopolitical context they happened in. And to understand that really is to understand that these Crusades were a response to Muslim Empire conquest. That's just the historical, it's not particularly a Christian group, Christian hang-up here. If you flip open a book about the Crusades, that will be the social setting. If you did a course on the Crusades, that would be the social setting. It has to be understood within that context. So Islam was founded in the early 7th century by Muhammad. He was a religious founder and prophet, and in his leading and founding of a religion, he became a warrior. He united the Arab peoples, and by then invading towns and cities, brought a unity under this new religion, Islam, in the Arab Peninsula. At the close of his life, Muhammad had then a charge to his followers to expand the abode of Islam, the Dar al-Islam, throughout the wider world. And so we find this at various points that are towards the end of life bits of the Quran, because the Quran covers a long period of time, but those bits towards the end of his life, we find things such as in Surah 9, where Muhammad says, "When the sacred months pass, kill the polytheists wherever you find them and capture them and besiege them and lie in wait for them at every ambush. But if they repent and perform the prayers and pay the alms, then let them go their own way. God is most merciful and most forgiving. But if they violate their oaths after their pledge and attack your religion, then fight the leaders of disbelief. They have no faith, so they must desist. Will you not fight a people who violated their oaths and planned to exile the messenger and initiated hostilities against you? Do you fear them? It's God you should fear if you are believers. Fight them. God will punish them at your hands and humiliate them and help you against them and heal the hearts of a believing people." And so after the death of Muhammad in 632 AD, the Islamic Empire, under then his successors, expanded very rapidly. And over the next 100 years, conquered and subdued Persia, Egypt, Syria. And into the 8th century, the Islamic Empire reached even to Spain, through Africa to Spain, and made attempts up into France in 732 AD. And so at this point, the Western Europeans are really sitting up and taking notice. Some people, I mean, there's debate about this amongst various historians, but some have said if that France battle, the Battle of Tours, had gone differently, then it would be possible that actually in Oxford there'd be theological classes on the Quran as the dominant thing, and mosques all through Oxford and Cambridge. Such a threat it was perceived to be to the European culture that was watching it come their way. And so the background for the Crusades is the efforts In those centuries, this is the Crusades aren't until the 11th century, but even here in the 8th and 9th centuries, the attempts to try and, in a sense, push this Muslim empire back down into Spain and out of Europe altogether, what they called the Reconquest, the Reconquista, to try and remove the Islamic, what they saw as the Islamic invaders, the Islamic empire from Europe. And so that's the broader kind of cultural context of the rapid, vast, seemingly unstoppable rise of the Islamic world over several centuries. But it's not the immediate trigger. The immediate trigger was a rise of a different kind of Muslim again. We've been talking so far of the Arab Muslims. But sometime in the 11th century, maybe the 10th century, Turkish peoples, the Seljuks, converted to Islam. And it seems were very kind of, you could say, maybe today's language, fundamentalist, very earnest, devout, serious, to the point where they were kind of shocked at how the Arab Muslims tolerated and accepted churches and church people in their empire. They were sort of shocked at this, some writers say, until they realised it's good economics to keep the churches there, because then you get the pilgrims come with their pilgrim money. But the Seljuks rose up and conquered Armenia, Syria, and Palestine, so this is where Jerusalem is, and caused instability in that whole region. They killed some clergy, made it harder for Christians in the region and Jews in the region, but also made it hard for Europeans who would travel to Jerusalem on a pilgrimage. It became harder to do that. That kind of religious travel became more difficult under the Seljuk reign as well. They then began expanding their reign and stretched up. I've always got to get the map right from your point. That's right, isn't it? That's kind of west. Yeah. So then up towards Constantinople, and the Bosphorus kind of little sort of strait of water there. So that here you have the kind of capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, Constantinople, looking just across a thin strait of water, you know, like Bruny Island across to Kettering, and there is the Turkish Empire right at their door. Wars were fought. One of the Byzantine, Eastern European emperors was captured by the Turks. And a new emperor, Alexius I Comnenus, rallied his people, raised an army, and called to the West for help. So that's the context, right? A plea for help. Please help us. And so in the 11th century, at the Council of Clermont in November, the Roman Catholic leader, Pope Urban II, announces this to the Western Christians and says, we've got this call for help from the East, from this impending, the overturn of Jerusalem. Well, listen to how he describes it. Here's one of the accounts. For your brethren who live in the East are in urgent need of your help. You must hasten to give them the aid which has often been promised them. For, as the most of you have heard, the Turks and Arabs have attacked them and have conquered the territory of Romania as far west as the shore of the Mediterranean and Hellespont, which is called Arm of St. George. They've occupied more and more of the lands of those Christians and overcome them in seven battles. They've killed and captured many and have destroyed the churches and devastated the empire. If you permit them to continue thus for a while with impurity, the faithful of God will be much more widely attacked by them. On this account, rather the Lord, beseech you as Christ's heralds to publish this everywhere and to persuade all peoples of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this as those who are present. It means also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it. There's a few different accounts of this. Another one comes from Robert the Monk. Imagine that you're chatting to someone afterwards. What's your name? Robert the Monk. and he goes into a little bit more detail about the experience of the Christians at that time in the East. He said, they, the Turks, have completely destroyed some of God's churches and they've converted others to the uses of their own cult. So this is, again, for deeply religious people, for their religious buildings to be, and this is, again, a Roman Catholic peoples for whom the buildings were considered very holy places, to be not only destroyed, but some of them even turned into their mosques. Very distressing for these people, right? They ruin the altars with filth and defilement. They circumcise Christians and smear blood from the circumcision over the altars or throw it into the baptismal fonts. They're pleased to kill others by cutting open their bellies, extracting the end of their intestines and tying it to a stake. And then with flogging, they drive their victims around the stake. When their viscera have spilled out, they fall dead on the ground. They tie others again to stakes and shoot arrows at them. They seize others, stretch out their necks, and try to see whether they can cut off their heads with a single blow of a naked sword. And what shall I say of the shocking rape of women? He calls for help. And so the story goes, people began to then shout out, yes, God wills it, God wills it, let's do something. And so is the call to what came to be called the First Crusade. This is the trigger. Does that make it then a just war, a justified war? Well, how do you justify a war? Christians historically and primitively, from the birth of Jesus, a founding of Christianity, have inclined to peace. Maybe if you have a Bible and can get around it quick enough, you might want to come and have a look at Matthew chapter 6, a very famous part of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount that we look at in that Christianity 1A course. Not Matthew chapter 6, Matthew chapter Matthew chapter 5, isn't it? Matthew chapter 5, verse 38. You've heard it said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, Matthew 5:39, I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone wants you to sue you to take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you and turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. In Luke 22, that was read for us by Jed, when the disciples go to defend Jesus and draw swords and cut off the ear of one of those come to arrest him, Jesus says, enough of that, put the swords away. In another account, in Matthew's gospel, he says, those who draw the sword die by the sword. In another story, the story of in John's story of Jesus' trial before Pilate, Jesus says, my kingdom's not of this world. If my kingdom was of this world, I'd call my followers to defend me. But my kingdom is from another place. In 1 Corinthians 6, perhaps you might want to be able to get there if you can quick enough, we have this kind of attitude spilled over into primitive Christian ethical outlook, where in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 7, the apostle says, the very fact that you have lawsuits among you means you've been completely defeated already. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated? Instead, you wrong and cheat, and you do this to your brothers. And even the hope for Christians in the end is a hope of peace in the end, where one of the beautiful prophet descriptions is that, Isaiah, is that the lion and the child and the ox and the snake all lie down together in peace, and people take their implements of war and turn them into implements for farming, beating their spears into plowshares. So Christianity has inclined to peace, but not absolutely under every circumstance. It's not that Christianity has an entire ethic of pacifism. Jesus met many soldiers, and his apostles met many soldiers in the scriptures, and yet we don't find in any of that teaching, if you will come after me, lay down your soldiering and abandon your military post. Jesus, in that passage that was read to us from Luke 22, as he speaks about the trouble coming for his apostles, says to them, this will be a difficult time, so be prepared with self-defense. Those, if you don't have a sword, buy a sword. They say, here we've got 2 swords, and he says, well, that's enough. It's not saying, man up and fight, but it's dangerous times ahead, be ready to defend yourself. Or Romans chapter 13 in the Bible describes government as being something God can use to bring justice. And the government has the sword, that passage says, to ensure punishment for what is wrong and reward for what is right. So there is, you could say, one way to draw the distinction is to say there's a difference between violence, that is illegitimate force, and then force, legitimate appropriate use of force, right? As Christians came into the 4th century and the Roman Empire became Christianized under Constantine, suddenly they had to answer these questions. What do we do now that we're together with the government, being asked questions by the government? The government would ask the Christians and preachers their advice on ethics. Just like in the 60s and 70s, Christian theologians were involved in bioethics because we were just looking for people who think a lot. And you guys seem to think a lot and have a whole lot of stuff where you've thought about this. What do you reckon? That began to happen in the 4th century. And so the Christian theorists, like Augustine, began to build on the bits and pieces from Greek and Roman philosophy to form a theory of war, drawing again on Christian teachings. And here's what they came up with, right? A war can only be started if you have certain kind of criteria met, all right? A war is justified if it's a defensive, protective war. So a war to go and just take stuff from someone else, if you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, what if someone has something that I really want? Can I then take it? What if I want it more than them? No, that's still really bad. it's not that kind of, if I want to expand my territory, I need more living room, I need to expand. No. It's got to be a defensive, protective war. It's got to be initiated by a legitimate authority. So that's one of the problems with terrorism, is terrorism is not a government waging war against a government. It's a bunch of randoms waging war against a bunch of, again, non-government, but right? Another requirement of just war is that it must involve first seeking diplomatic. It must be a last resort. You've sought every other peaceful avenue first. There must be some likelihood of success. Otherwise, it becomes a vexatious and suicidal business. It must be proportional, you know, so you don't... Someone takes a little bit of land, you nuke all of them, you know. And the goal must ultimately be to restore peace. So they're the kind of causes for war. That, you know, it's got to be proportional, it's got to be protective, defensive, it's got to be likelihood of success and so on. And they also had things about the kind of way that you did the war. Again, proportional. Focused on military goals. So don't just go around smashing people's sandcastles to be vindictive, but there must be a military strategic purpose to what you're doing. You must only fight against combatants. Again, a problem with terrorism is that terrorism targets non-combatants deliberately. If people surrender, they must be treated fairly. If people are captured, they must be treated fairly. And don't use weapons or tactics which are evil in and of themselves. So sexual violence as a war tactic is evil in and of itself. So with that in mind, insofar, I think that's a pretty helpful description of things that captures, we could spend some time to reflect on the degree to which that reflects biblical ethics. With that in mind, how do the Crusades stand up? Well, here is an appeal for help from a conquered and victimized people experiencing injustice and aggression. You could say that that is a legitimate thing to come to their aid. And in fact, after the First Crusade, here's an interesting first-hand description from Fuller of Chartres describing what the Christian kingdoms looked like after the First Crusade. He says, "Consider and reflect on how God has in our time changed the West into the East. For we, who were from the West, Occidentals, have now become Easterners, Orientals. The man who was Roman or Frank has now, in this land, been turned into a Galilean or a Palestinian. He who was once a citizen of Rheims or Chartres has now become a citizen of Tyre or Antioch. We've already forgotten the places where we were born. Many of us either don't know them or have never even heard of them. One among you now has his own houses and retainers, just as if he possessed them through family right. Another takes his wife, not a woman of his own stock, but rather a Syrian or an Armenian or even, occasionally, an Arab, a Saracen, who has obtained the grace of baptism. Men address one another in turn in the speech and idiom of various languages. The several languages of various nations are common here, and one joins faith with men whose forefathers were strangers. For it is written, the lion and ox shall eat straw side by side." Peace was attained at various points, not for very long often, but there were decades there of peace, and the desire was peaceful harmony, loving, living alongside one another. there's a curious comment from one Muslim person describing these crusader neighbours and saying, we get on pretty well. We like each other. It's just that they let their women walk around in public wearing kind of normal clothes. It's kind of, it's not very modest. But it was that kind of that interesting intercultural peace was the goal. And, I mean, in that sense, you could evaluate the Crusades as any other war. Potentially justified, but mixed, complicated, but with some legitimate goals. Yeah? What about the Crusades? To which you could say, what about any war? People sometimes have to go to war, or in good conscience choose to go to war, and it's messy. Even religious people sometimes find themselves seeing that the right thing might be to have to go to war, and it's messy. But there were other motives and factors in the Crusades which were less justifiable. Some people think possibly a hidden motive is that the Pope wants to bring control for the Roman Catholic Church over into the Eastern Church, or unite the whole Holy Roman Empire East and West. It was a political move. Well, that's not very justifiable reason for a war, to garner favours. Some think that maybe it was because, and he does mention this in his speech, there's all these knights geared up with all their knight stuff and kind of pumped full of kind of knightly sort of chivalry kind of notions. And they're just going around sort of lancing and swording each other because that's what knights do. And the Pope says, well, you're doing this anyway. How about you just do it that way? So in a sense, you could say, well, that's a noble redirecting of testosterone to a useful end. Or you could say, well, is this just then, you know, a little bit like the colonisation of Australia dealing with a British population problem? Is it a bit that kind of thing? We've got the third son, you know, there's Sir Dwayne and Sir Scott, and then there's Derek. And we don't know what to do with Derek, so let's send him off on the Crusades. Was it trying to find extra lands for peoples? That wouldn't be such a good goal. And so some suggest that it was really a power grab. It was the first imperialism, the first colonialism. It's doubtful, considering just how wretched, miserable, and expensive these Crusades were. If they were wanting to just extend their empire, a stupid way to do that. But to the extent that any of these things, along with just arrogance and pursuit of kind of glory and so on, yuck. Some of the later Crusades get even more muddy. Once the Kingdom of Jerusalem is established, along with the county of Edessa and the Principality of Antioch and Tripoli and so on, it then falls, it then rises, and then people start squabbling over who's the right king of these places. It soon gets just to the messy story of politics, where is this just anymore? Are we restoring Jerusalem, or are we helping out the mate that had the fight with the other mate that then made the deal with the Turk? You know, it starts to get a little bit kind of messy, a bit of a Game of Thrones. And then they decide that the best way to protect Jerusalem is to attack Egypt, and so now we're down in Egypt, not in Jerusalem, and then that doesn't work, so then a guy says that he should be the king of Constantinople. And before you know it, in the, which crusade, was that the fifth crusade? The fourth crusade? The fourth crusade, they end up actually fighting Eastern Christians and ransacking Constantinople. Well, how did we end up here? So some of the other crusades have more dubious causes altogether. The idea of crusades began to get used to deal with unstable areas within Europe, and so southern France, which had a strange sect called the Albigensians, which was kind of politically unstable, they then had a little crusade waged against them. So what about the crusades? Were they just? Depends. Some? A bit? Some were? Some weren't? To different degrees. But it isn't true to say that the Crusades were unusually and remarkably unjust. It's not true to say that they were extraordinarily and horrifically unjust in their motivations. Yeah? A cynical interpretation of history that says, here are these mad, barbaric Europeans just wanting to grab and loot and rape and conquer. most, it seems, of the kind of latest historical research that I could get access to. I was reading one guy, Thomas Madden, we'll quote from a bit, who's a leading medievalist. He says, here's a good summary. He says, a crusade army was a curious mix of rich and poor, saints and sinners, motivated by every kind of pious and selfish desire, yet it could not have come into being without the pious, that is kind of religious, idealism that led men to risk all to liberate the lands of Christ. Whole mix, but it would never have happened if it wasn't for a religious idealism that wanted to rescue and liberate people in the lands where Jesus was born, died and rose. Yeah. I mean, listen to the way that various popes... Here's the Second Crusade. He says, our predecessors laboured for the deliverance of the Eastern Church. The archbishops of this city, Edessa, now, along with his clergy and many other Christians, have been slain. Their relics and their saints have been given over to be trampling underfoot by the infidels. These great dangers threaten the Church of God and the whole of Christianity. We both know ourselves shouldn't hide from this. We should prove our nobility in the same way our forefathers did and help them. Or the Third Crusade, Pope Gregory. Whoever doesn't mourn, at least in his heart, in so great a cause for sorrow, not only is ignorant of the Christian faith, which teaches us to join in all suffering, but of our very humanity. From the magnitude of the dangers and their barbarous ferocity, thirsting for the blood of Christians, and adding all their power in this cause to profane the holy and erase the name of God from that land, whomever thinks we should be silent should decide. How about the conduct of the Crusaders, though, before we move on from this first and biggest point? I told you it was the biggest. How did they behave? Did they behave in a just war way? Well, no, often. And that's partly because the Crusade was not a general with an army going on a war. It was, technically speaking, kind of weirdly, a pilgrimage where when you got to the end of the pilgrimage, you killed people. That was kind of the way it was constructed by Pope Urban, right? And so it was just a bunch of pilgrims. And they were all going, some under, you know, large national groups, some more under small collections of knights, and then a whole bunch of randoms. This led to a really bizarre story in the 13th century later on, what has been called the Children's Crusade. A bunch of people began going, these crusades aren't working. Maybe it's because we're using swords. Let's not use swords. Jesus was peaceful. Let's be peaceful. And so this guy in 1212, Nicholas of Cologne, thought that God told him that he would get to the sea, God would part the sea, he would walk to Jerusalem and then take it for Jesus. Solved. That's the whole thing they were missing. Just walk through the sea and take it peacefully. Nicholas has got this. It actually captivated the imagination of many people, and soon thousands were following Nicholas on this journey. I mean, eventually some turned back along the way, and as they got closer to the water, they disagreed about which port was where the sea was going to part. And when they finally then, Nicholas got to Genoa on the 25th of August, 1212, the sea didn't part. It didn't part. Anticlimax. Some of his followers went to Marseille, and they got a free trip to Palestine, where when they got there, the people who brought them there just sold them to Egyptian slave traders. It's awful. But that shows you just the mix of random people and the weirdness of this whole sort of season. And so that means there was a real mix of motives and a real mix of morals amongst the people involved. Indeed, even among the religious and the devout knights, they, as in every age, religious people can be very inconsistent. There were knights who were devoutly religious, but also fought, stole, slept around, and worse. And that was the whole reason they were going on the crusade, was with the hope that through this pilgrimage, their sins would be forgiven. So what was their conduct going to be like? And so, yeah, throughout the stories of the crusades are horrible stories of looting and rape. There is at least one story in the First Crusade of the remnants of those crusaders finally getting almost to Jerusalem and being so starving that they began, at least some of them, cooking and eating the corpses of Turkish people in the city of Merara. There are awful stories of crusaders getting sidetracked off into the Rhineland where wealthy Jews lived and began anti-Semitic slaughter. But it's worth noting and it's worth saying that it's not as if the Pope was saying, go to the East and loot and pillage and rape and slaughter and kill all the Jews. The Pope wasn't saying that. In the Rhineland, the bishops helped protect the Jews at the risk of their own life to try and keep the Jews safe from this pillaging. Yeah? It's not that this was the ordained plan, was to go and kill and slaughter and cannibalize and do pogroms. Pogrom, if you don't know, it's like a Jewish kind of lynching. It's one of those examples of a pretty word that means an awful thing. One of the most memorable examples of horrible behaviour, if you were at Tuesday night at John Dixon's lecture, he mentioned this. It was the massacre that took place when Jerusalem was stormed. Here's one of the accounts from Rabban Daguilier. Strange to relate, however, at this time, when the city was practically captured by the Franks, the Saracens were still fighting on the other side, where the court was attacking the wall as though the city should never be captured. But now that our men had possession of the walls and the towers, wonderful sights were to be seen. Some of our men cut off the heads of their enemies, others shot them with arrows so they fell from the towers, others tortured them longer by casting them into the flames. Piles of heads, hands and feet were to be seen in the streets of the city. It was necessary to pick one's way over the bodies of men and horses, but these were small matters compared to what happened at the Temple of Solomon, a place where the religious services ordinarily were chanted. That was a misnaming of the location. But what happened there, he says, if I tell you the truth, it will exceed the powers of belief. Let it suffice to say this much at least, that in the Temple and the Porch of Solomon, men rode in blood up to their knees and bridle reins. Indeed, it was a just and splendid judgment of God that this place should be filled with the blood of unbelievers, since it suffered so long from their blasphemies. The city was filled with corpses and blood. Some of the enemy took refuge in the Tower of David and, petitioning Count Raymond for protection, surrendered the tower into his hands. Our men followed, killing and slaying, even to the Temple of Solomon, where the slaughter was so great the men waded up to their ankles, another description describes, and so on. It's disturbing to hear that kind of thing, isn't it? Horrid. We hear this, and there's something right in us to be outraged. And for a Christian who loves peace, it's right for a Christian to feel disturbed and to feel alienated from a fellow Christian who writes this as a... Were there cruelties here that were in excess? Probably so, yeah. If I were sent back in time as I am now into that location, would I be horrified and would I participate? No way. Whoa. And yet the tricky thing is to see this within the social technology of that age, within the ethics and the practices of what was normal at that age. If I went back today in a time machine, would I participate? No. If you or I grew up in that culture, would we participate? Well, maybe most likely yes. You see, the social and moral technology of that time and the way they thought about what was expected behaviour in war was different to our time, just as the pressures for survival were different. And so for us to kind of tut-tut from a distance, to some extent can be a little bit useless, as a sociologist, Rodney Start, says about this. Granted, it was a cruel age, it was a bloody age, but nothing is to be gained in moral insight or historical comprehension by imposing the Geneva Convention back on those times. We've got to understand them within their own setting. Yeah? And within their own setting, this was a siege. This was a war, and this was a siege. And in a siege, when you have a city surrounded, they need to surrender. It is the duty of the leaders of the city, if they see they're going to lose, to surrender for their well-being. Within that time, if they refuse to surrender, then once the walls are breached, everyone are combatants, rebellious combatants. And so it was normal for Muslims and Christians and for everybody. It was just how war was waged, awful as it seems to us, for widespread slaughter to take place for everyone inside a sieged city. It was horrible as we look back to think that that was normal. But the point here is not to say that was okay, but to say that it wasn't remarkably awful It was the kind of awful that medieval people did normally. Again, as Thomas Madden, the American medievalist, says, by the standards of the time, both Christians and Muslims, the Crusaders would have been justified in their actions, despite highly exaggerated reports, however. It is true that many of the inhabitants, both Muslims and Jews, were killed, yet many were also allowed to purchase their freedom or were simply sent out of the city. Stories about Jerusalem coursing with knee-high rivers of blood were never meant to be taken literally. Medieval people knew this was an impossibility. Modern people, however, often do not, unfortunately. The longest point by far. The Crusades were horrible. Mixed motives, plenty to be horrified. But really, the big point I've been saying in all of that is just to say they were also, at the time, in many ways, unremarkable. Yeah? Nothing peculiarly horrible about them. Yeah? What was unusual about the Crusades, and this is the second shorter point before we then think of relevance for us, what is unusual is their novelty, the imaginative novelty of Pope Urban II to make them religious wars. All right, the Crusades, were they holy wars? That's our second point, right? For Jews, there was a time when there was a holy war for them in the Old Testament. Joshua and Moses spoke of being God's instruments to bring a punishment in a war in Palestine. So 14th, 15th century or 13th, 12th, around then, BC. It was a limited conflict that was unlike any other war that the Jews waged. Yeah? And even then, there were texts which suggested there was space for surrender and pardon. Yeah? That was the Jews. For the Muslims, as we've already discussed, traditional historical Islam had a much stronger tradition, what's called holy war, jihad, the expansion of the Islamic world. Now, I'm not saying every single Muslim holds to that today. Islam can be very diverse. But that traditional, original Islam, that's what they held to. That it was godly and honourable to extend Islam by war. Jews had one instance of holy war, but didn't continue to practice it. Islam had more of a stance of holy war traditionally. Christians didn't. Jesus instead said, turn the other cheek. He said, love your enemies. He said, put away your sword. He said, my kingdom is not of this world. His apostle Paul said in Ephesians 6, our struggle is not against people, but against spiritual forces. Our hope is not for a kingdom in this world. Our method for Christian expansion is not empire. But for the first three or four centuries, Christianity spread rapidly through persuasion and through love and through community and through preaching. And wherever Christianity is healthy, it spreads not through war and empire, but through persuasion and good deeds and love and preaching. But in the Crusades, we find something alien and novel and unchristian in the way these wars were described. Because Urban II and all those after him said, I want you guys to go on a pilgrimage to the east. And when you finish your pilgrimage, your act of worship is to conquer, to reconquer, to reclaim, to liberate. It's a fighting pilgrimage. And actually, they even developed military monks during this time. There were various groups like the Hospitallers who originally were like hosts. To welcome in travellers and needy people and run hospital care for the sick and the needy. There were the Knights Templar, again, monks, who then kind of got turned into monks with swords. And so we had then this creation of a whole bunch of crusading monks, religious warriors providing stability in these newly established crusader states in the East. For Pope Urban said, all who die by the way, whether by land or sea, or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins. I grant this through the power of God. That's why it was so exciting to the Europeans. Forgiveness of sins. Freedom from hell. Awesome. And as I've already said, for the knights, my whole life is slaying and killing and I feel sort of guilty about it, but now I can do what I do, slay and kill, and get forgiven. Awesome. And so there was an enthusiasm, there was a passion around this. And preachers went and preached the cross, as they called it, which meant deny yourself, take up a cross-shaped symbol, and go and fight. Very different from Jesus' original teaching. There's a humorous story, though, that tells you much more what true Christianity should be like in the Crusades. Have you heard of St. Francis of Assisi? Who's heard of that name before, St. Francis of Assisi? He was famous for preaching to animals and things, is one of the stories about him. And he's misquoted as saying, preach the gospel, and if necessary, use words. I think it's questionable whether he ever said that. And the other day I heard someone respond to that silly saying by saying, that's a little bit like saying, feed the poor, and if necessary, use food. The gospel is words. You know, you preach the gospel with words. Anyway, St. Francis Assisi, during the Fifth Crusade, he came and turned up in the Crusader camp and said, I'm here to help with the Crusade. And they thought, okay, you're here to help maybe in a diplomatic way, to negotiate with the Turks and the Arabs. And he goes, no. My plan is I'm going to convert them. Let me at them. I'm going to go over there, meet the Sultan. I'm going to preach Jesus to him. He'll get converted. Problem solved. And they said, that's a dumb idea. St. Francis kept going at it, so the story goes, until they went, all right, off we go. And so he goes over. And the Sultan's men welcome him, thinking, well, I guess he's here to negotiate. That's good. Finally, they're seeing their sense. We can make peace. This was when the conflict was down in Egypt. And so they bring him in to see the Sultan. And he goes, thank you so much for seeing me, Sultan. Shall we talk about why Muhammad's not a true prophet of God? And begins sort of expounding on the errors of Islam and the truth of Christianity. And the Sultan's advisors go, we've got to kill this guy, how dare he? This is blasphemous and all this kind of stuff. But at least the story goes, the Sultan kind of liked this guy. Was fascinated. And so I had a conversation with him and listened to him, didn't convert to Christianity, but then sent him back on his way peacefully. Isn't that a great story? I tell the story partly because I've been talking for a long time and it's funny. But I also tell the story because at that point, Francis of Assisi was right. That's the business of Christians. That's our concern. That's our pilgrimage, is to preach the gospel and, since it's necessary, to use words to do so. To speak the words, the saving words of peace and life. When Jesus said, take up your cross, he didn't say, sew a cross on your tunic and go and fight. And so die your life. He said, no, take up your cross to identify with me for the salvation of the world, to preach the message of salvation. Yeah? The church had been distracted because the Pope had drawn to himself greater and greater power. He had become, eventually, you see, the centre of stability in Europe as the Roman Empire declined. And actually, just before the Crusades, Gregory the VII had declared that he was the supreme authority on earth and could even kick out emperors if he needed to. And so the Pope had brought all power to himself. He actually read this passage. He quoted this, one of the later popes quoted this passage from Luke that we had read, about two swords. Just a random event, right, where Jesus says, you will need to protect yourselves, so get some swords. They say, here's two swords. Jesus says, that's enough. A later pope said, two swords. Military power and spiritual power. Jesus said, that's enough. He didn't say, that's too much. Two swords. You got two swords. The Pope and the Church has military power and spiritual power. Such a woeful use of Bible. They even quoted the other one of when Peter goes to defend Jesus when he's arrested and Jesus says, put away your sword. They went, put it away. Not throw it away, just put it away. You've still got the sword. Just not right. I know, right? This is a place where the traditional Roman Catholic Church went way away from biblical teaching and from Jesus' teaching, and gave power and authority, including worldly military power and authority, to the Roman bishop that goes way beyond anything that we can find in Scripture itself and caused so many problems. Let's bring this to a close by me commenting briefly on the three areas of relevance for us today. First, Islamic attitudes to the Crusades. Today, Islamic nationalists and radicals point to the Crusades as a justification for their anger at the West. In a closing chapter of his History of the Crusades, that medievalist I've mentioned, Thomas Madden, observes that actually Muslims didn't really care about the Crusades at the time. It was a mosquito bite for their great empire. They didn't write about the Crusades. In fact, they didn't even have a word for Crusaders until the 18th century. It was only once Islam began to decline and Britain and other European colonies began to expand that the Islamic world even really thought about the stories of the Crusades. And at that time of decline, suddenly went, And then as they began to encounter secular Westerners critiquing the Crusades, they went, yeah, we like those critiques as well. And so as Madden reflects on the history, he says, it's not the Crusades that led to the attack of September 11, but the artificial memory of the Crusades, constructed by modern colonial powers, passed down by Arab nationalists and Islamists. They stripped the medieval expeditions of every aspect of their age. They dressed them up instead in the tattered rags of 19th century imperialism. As such, they've become an icon for modern agendas that medieval Christians and medieval Muslims would scarcely have understood, let alone condoned. By all means, sympathise with those distressed with the unstable and frustrating world of the Middle East today. But don't take the claim that the Crusades is the cause of it all that seriously, or at least see it as a problematic claim. Second, secular rejection of Christianity. I hope we've covered this enough, yeah? That there's been enough that's been interesting and that's filled in the gaps for you to see there was much that was shocking about these wars. They had failures and they had horrors, as do all wars. But these wars also had legitimate motivations, which many wars don't have. If anything, what the Crusades demonstrate is that Christian societies can be flawed and corrupt and imperfect, both their leaders and their citizens, foolishly and wickedly. But I hope I've also shown that there's nothing particularly problematic about Christianity that the Crusades show. What about the Crusades? You go, yeah, I know a bit more about them than you do probably now, because I was at that uni fellowship thing. And I think all they show is what the Bible teaches about the flawed nature of humanity and a misunderstanding of Christianity. They don't show much problematic stuff about genuine Christianity. I think you can say that in good conscience. They show a lot about what the Bible does teach, that humans are flawed, but not a great deal about the problems with genuine Christianity. The great problem with the Crusades was a theology that turned wars into pilgrimages, which was a Roman Catholic invention that had nothing to do with biblical ethics or biblical politics, let alone with Christian religion or spirituality. So then last of all, those of you who are Christians here, what can you learn? Let's talk to you now. What can you guys learn? Three quick things. First, it is healthy to keep a distance between your religion and your politics. It's healthy to keep a distance there, right? I think the Crusades teaches that. When the Pope absorbed all power and authority and then blurred religious causes with military causes, great problems and inconsistencies came up. The Popes thought they'd purify the church by kicking out the emperors and giving the Pope all the power. No, they just, you know, it's four legs good, two legs bad, all went out the window and the Pope became the new emperor with corruptions. You should let your religion shape all of your life. Christian spirituality, Jesus is Lord of all, yes. But as you work out your Christian faith in everyday life, keep some distinctions in place. Keep some distinctions in place, right? Let me give a very contemporary example, right? We've got a plebiscite vote about same-sex marriage coming up. I'm inclined to vote no to that, because I don't think there's any good reason to change the definition of marriage. And I think there are practical problems that could come that we maybe don't even expect. So I think there are good, very good reasons to vote no. Ethical reasons, leaving aside religion, but good religious reasons too. But voting for a political party that promises to hold a plebiscite, or choosing to vote in a plebiscite, or voting in a plebiscite about a law for a secular country called Australia, these are not the Christian crusade. This is not the Christian agenda. This is not what we as Christians are about. There is a gap between your faith and ethics and your political actions. Your faith and ethics influence those things. But I just always worry when that line blurs, and so we start saying the big fight of today. Fight, awful word. The big fight is the plebiscite. Really? For goodness sake. The big fight is for the hearts and minds, the souls of men and women, that they may be united to their God through faith in Jesus Christ. That's the big fight. Whatever they can do in the secular laws. Yeah. Marriage certificates and such things are small, microscopic things compared to the grand concerns that we Christians have. Preach the gospel to them like St. Francis of Assisi. It's far more important in the end, yeah? Yeah, that's an example, right? Keep a principled gap in between what you do as a Christian in your church. Even though your religion applies to every area of your life, be clear on what are the unique Christian things. Yeah? Yes, apply your faith to every area of life, but the gospel and loving your neighbor and worshiping God is more centrally Christian to you than progressive politics or conservative politics or cultural or ethnic distinctives or business and economic interests. These things sleaze their way into the church. And so suddenly we have Uni Fellowship is brought to you by Vodafone, power to you. and also by the office of Senator blah, 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 blah. You know, and suddenly we're... No, let's just keep a bit of a gap there, I think is a lesson we learn. Second lesson we learn, and maybe less contentious. Living in a volatile world will be messy. We have to seek to do right as best as we can. We need to be careful that we don't fall into the sins of our culture, especially when it comes to using force. And that's where the Crusaders fell into the norms of their age in bad ways. Maybe in our age, that could be the way we use litigation and law courts and personal rights, that we fight too much a fire around rights and litigation rather than asking, is this the Christian way to be? How do you deal with sharehouse conflicts? How do you deal with unfair marks on your university assignments? Yeah? Do you deal with those conflicts Christianly? Yeah? How do you deal with violence? It's right to say no to sexual abuse and sexual attack. But can we say a firm, strong, stern no to those who might bully or worse while not slipping into hatred of others? That's tricky, yeah? Thirdly, the great concern, and I'll finish with this, the great concern for the Christians and the church is our unique identity as Christians and the church to worship God, to love our neighbour, and to preach the gospel. That's the unique need for the world. That's the unique power that Christians have. We must beware of other crusades which distract us from that. And I think in order to preserve that, we do need places where we preserve our unique identity separate from all these other things, the politics or the ethnic identity or the, you know, all these, the cultural cool, whatever it is, to go, actually, at the moment, we're being Christian, concerned for Christian concerns. Again, a comment in the stuff that we had with these guys, John Dixon and Simon Smart. I think Simon Smart at one point said at a breakfast on the Wednesday morning, Christianity thrives on the fringes. Christianity thrives on the fringes. When, like in the Middle Ages, it gets into the centre, it starts to get wonky. What are ways that even though we might have a lot of privilege in Australia, a lot of influence in many ways, that we can stay, in another sense, a fringe community? Yeah? That's the thing to keep thinking about. How can we be a unique, set-apart, holy people? Yeah? That's a great thing for to think about, hey? We'll stop there. We're going to have questions in a second, but I'm conscious that people might need to stretch their legs and things. So maybe stretch your legs. If you're done for the night, you're very welcome to sneak out. But if you'd like to participate in questions, we'll...
So we are going to take some questions from the floor. Thank you for the messages that you've already sent in. We're going to start off with one of those. So if you could put that up on the screen behind me for all to see, we'll get rolling. Hello. Mikey, you mentioned that sexual violence was wrong in and of itself. Isn't that true of any form of violence?
So that was where I made the distinction about proper use of force and violence. There's a proper time and place. If someone is coming at you to kill you, it is awful but possibly necessary for you to kill them to save your life. So that's killing in that sense. There are justified forms of killing. There's no parallel case for sexual violence. Does that make sense? So there are times where an undesirable thing, like killing, might be what we call the lesser of two evils, and that's a right thing. But there are some things where that's never the case. Mm. Yeah.
There's no form of self-defense in sexual violence. Like, that's like sexual violence is never in a self-defense way, really. Like, as far as I can see. Mm. Yeah.
Well, we'll take another question from the text line then.
Are there any more microphones, by the way, events team characters? Yeah? Is there one up here somewhere? Just think it's a bit awkward. There we go. Does that one? Can we make that one work? That way Tom can keep his magic wand.
Yes, thank you. All right, here's this next question. Christians still suffer under Islam today. How should we help them? They're being killed and enslaved.
One thought, Amnesty International is one thing you can do. It's a sick kind of a not a religious thing you can do, but basically the principle of Amnesty International letter writing is that everybody is egotistical deep down, and so if a ruler gets enough people sending them hate mail, then they might change their mind. And so that's one small possible thing that you could do, is just actually send human rights hate mail to people saying treat people more justly and fairly, and that sometimes can help. So that's one thing just to get the ball rolling, but there are much better things than that.
Starting point, if you're a Christian, pray for them. Ask God to help them, because we want to revert to God. We don't want to try and solve their problems by military force. We want to ask God to solve their problems and God to help them, and that God's will be done in those countries. Also, as Mikey was saying, there's a distinction between what is a religious problem and what is a political problem. And in this case, you might go on religiously, we need to pray for them, but then also something needs to be done by our state and our armies and our forces, but that's a step separate from... And our opinion on that is influenced by our religion and our want to help our brothers and sisters, but it's a problem that's bigger than religion and becomes a social justice problem.
And you are, by the way, sorry...
This is Hannah,
and this is Beth. Hannah's studying health sciences, and Beth is doing journalism. There we go. Sorry for not introducing our panel earlier. Did any of you guys have anything you wanted to add?
We want to be a society that welcomes people in need, and that's a big question in Australia. It's a big one because we're an island country, and so there's a sense of feeling exposed by our borders. But it's a big issue as well because it's just become a big issue politically, and so it's now this hot-button issue that... Sometimes I wonder is a bit like, we don't want to do, a political science PhD at UTAS said to me, we don't want to talk about Indonesia and its political threat to us because that would be just diplomatically clumsy to do. So instead we spend lots of time talking about refugees because there's a lot of people who will vote for us to talk about refugees. Mm. And so it's just become this political diversion for us. But I think we as Christians want to encourage Australia to be a safe place for people running away from violent regimes to be welcomed, and I think we want our voice to be heard to our government to say whatever concerns about public security and whatever else,
why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be? We don't want to at the cost of our safety. Do you know what I'm trying to say? At the cost of our safety, we don't want to lose our, what, you know, our humanity, our kindness. Yeah. And so that's another area.
Mm. Thanks very much for your thoughts. I'll take one from the floor in just a moment. But if there is another text on the question line, we'll take that. Does the claim the Crusades were wrong as they needlessly harmed humans hold little weight when coming from an atheistic worldview, as that view does not have a basis for inherent human worth? That's quite a big question. There's a lot in there. So, you know, allow us a bit of time to process.
It's also a statement, really, isn't it?
Also that.
Would it be... I suppose I would just ask, that may be philosophically coherent. Would it be persuasive in a conversation with an atheist? I'm not sure if it would be. Mm. Yeah. That's one thought.
Yeah, like part of the question is definitely looking at... you about. So say if it's an atheist friend that you have, then I think addressing what they're trying to talk to you about is really good, but also challenging some of their foundational views, like how do they even come to the conclusion that someone has inherent human worth, is a good way to start talking about why yourself as a Christian.
Yeah, so you might raise that larger issue, but not in a way that seems like you're evading the question. That you know, you're being asked a challenging question about the potential kind of violent wastefulness of a war, and you're going kind of almost what's called an ad hominem attack, where you attack the person. You go, well, you don't even have a ground for saying that, and it's kind of like, so you might answer the question first, and then say, but hey, on another topic, I notice how passionate you are, and one thing I love about you is how passionate you are about kind of the value of human life. But I'm just curious to know what. What's the, I know you're passionate about it, but what's the kind of philosophical basis for that? You know, if as a Christian, I believe God's the ground of all that's good and he made human beings and so they're valuable. What ground do you have? Yeah, so it could be a follow-up question, but make sure you answer the actual question. Yeah.
I suppose if they're seeing some particular issue with the Crusades, particularly the violence there, then you can say as a Christian, why you have an issue with it as well.
Okay, we'll take a question from the floor. I've seen a couple of hands up already. Over here at the front.
I know it's like it was a small point at the end of the talk, but you mentioned stuff about how our religiousness should be different from our politicalness. As a person who sort of had some, not issue, but like, you know, just a little... maybe a misunderstanding. Could you and possibly others explain what we should be doing during this time on that issue? I know it's a small point, but you know.
Yeah. Well, why don't we just, if you guys, and we don't have to talk particularly about the plebiscite, but more generally about how you think about faith and politics, because I think all of us would agree our faith affects our political behaviour, but also there is something of a distinction. It'd be interesting to hear how each of you guys think about that, because I'm sure you all have something to say.
The point that I took from Mikey's, with what Mikey was saying, was that I completely agree with him, was that our political agenda is not the focus of our faith. We are not Christians because we want the government to do what we want them to. We're Christians, and as Christians, we want people to know Jesus. We want people to come to him, and we want people to have salvation. If our political thoughts, which are formed from our Christianity as part of that view of the world,
losing our ability to talk about God and to share the gospel, then that's when it's stepping into the realm that it shouldn't be. It's not our primary focus. It's important, it's very important, and it's part of the worldview that we have as Christians, but it's not the primary focus.
I agree completely with what you're saying. But at the same time, as Christians and as citizens of a democracy, we have the right to vote and to have our statements and how we want Australia to be shaped to be heard. But we don't have to force that on people in a religious way. But we do have the right to vote the way we think we're called to within our religion. So that is, I think that's right and proper in our place in a democracy.
Yeah, and this plebiscite, it's not like we're forcing our Christianity onto people. The government is asking us, what do you guys, what do the citizens of our country think? We're citizens of our country. So that's a time where we can say what our belief is and the right way, the right place to do that, as long as we can still share.
An extra step I was also raising was how to cope with political strategy can be slightly different from ethics. So that's one extra thing. And an example of that comes up, like Tasmania had and Australia's had, with kind of the hung parliament situation, where what do you do if you have to compromise with people you disagree on? That forces you to then work out, well, how do we come up with decisions that might not be 100% what we'd want, you know, in every case. It might even be supporting a government that might have certain policies that I disagree with quite strongly, you know. And so I guess that's an area as well where we need to go. My faith influences all of that, but part of my faith and my political opinions involve that kind of messy world of compromise and political strategy. And we might even disagree exactly on what that looks like in terms of, I don't know, an area of taxation or something like that. Yeah.
Another question from the floor.
Going on from what you said there and the same sort of question, what about when it comes to you? So I think keeping a distance and certainly seeking to connect with people for the sake of the gospel rather than win arguments is a really, really important point. But I think a lot of the concern that Christians have and are voicing is more about what about when it comes to my front door? So So in counselling, and I'm asking that question, what about when it comes to me in terms of will you do marriage counselling with this particular couple that practice a certain lifestyle? What about using our church building? Those sorts of questions, when politics comes to you, I'd just love to hear your thoughts on that, because then it's really hard to separate it. But I think your argument was, what you're saying was more about just keeping that connection rather than being all about winning discussions on Facebook and the like.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that one, guys? When those moral issues affect your own, like work or friendship or share house or friendship group issues? It is really tricky, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. It is difficult. Yeah. So there are conscience points, aren't there, where you say, I won't participate in this or that ethical thing. Yep, and so it's knowing where those lines are.
I'd say take a look at the book of Daniel as well. It's a really good example of a solid Christian man living in a very different culture, not a Christian culture, and yet still being involved. And so, yeah, there's lots of advice in the book of Daniel on how to live in that sort of society.
Yeah, and that also has some great examples of when Daniel actually stood up and said, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to bow down and worship that idol. I am not going to eat the food that you've sacrificed to that idol. And that had some really real consequences in his life, including Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego got thrown into a fiery furnace because they said, we're not participating in your idol worship. So there's consequences sometimes.
Yeah, like there's definitely persecution that should be expected as well. We shouldn't be like, what the hell, where's this coming from? Like, that's, the Bible talks about persecution as well, so, but in saying that, do you just stubbornly hold to a view that you shouldn't because you're, people are telling you not to? No, you hold it because that's what you believe through the Bible.
I think it's important, there's the difference between participating in an act, an immoral act, where someone says, do something that goes against your conscience, you do it, you pull the trigger, you bow down to the idol, and so on and so forth, you perform the procedure that you don't feel you're willing to do, in moral conscience. Then there's complicity, and I think that's where it gets tricky, you know, Bethany mentioned trickiness. When am I complicit so much so that I feel like by being in the room, I'm saying it's okay? And when am I kind of going, well, my job here is just to, you know, like I have a hotel and a bunch of kind of a racist group wants to use our function room. I'm in the business of providing rooms for people to, as long as they're not breaking the law, to do whatever they like. Is it my moral job? Am I complicit in their racism if I let them use the function room in my hotel? It might be troubling for me, but in the end I'd say no. Like that's a perfectly fine thing to do. And so it's drawing those lines, though. At what point do I feel like I'm complicit in something, and at what point am I, you know, you're doing it, it's your fault that you're doing it.
I think it'd be important to define those lines for yourself quite early on, just so that you know where you are comfortable with, and, yeah, or else I guess it just keeps pushing until you reach a point where you're like, oh, it's a bit late now. But, you know, just finding out where you're comfortable. Sorry, that probably wasn't the best.
I mean, an example of that, like in another area again, is if a couple, like say an aunt and uncle, the aunt or the uncle breaks up the family, leaves their partner with the kids and runs off with someone, you know, someone else, and then wants to bring that someone else to family Christmas. What do you do? That's a very common example that maybe some of you, you know, is by welcoming them and be happy families and kiss and exchanging presents with this. It's tricky. Yeah. Yeah. So that you've got to think through those things in advance with love as and wisdom.
Thank you very much for your candor and your insights, guys. We're going to take one more question from the text line, which will appear behind me. It says, isn't it hypocrisy to criticize the Crusades for immorality when it is the morality of Christianity that gives us the lens through which we can condemn them? It's a little bit circular.
I don't think that it's just Christians who go to the Crusades and bad, war is bad, mass killing of people is bad. That's a commonly accepted thing in a world that values human life, which is the world that we live in.
Some people might criticise it as well by saying, like imagine Friedrich Nietzsche, who saw Christians and their ethic of love as being weak and pathetic. He might still say, there you are, you pathetic Christians, and you're not even consistent with your own patheticness. So I suppose you might even, maybe you don't agree. Even if you didn't agree, you could still run the loop of going, you Christians are always hypocrites and, you know, something like that, I suppose.
And I guess if we're looking at it through our lens of Christianity going, these people are all Christians, like they were claiming to be Christians, that holds them to the same like standard that we hold ourselves to. So we're looking at them, yes, through the moral lens of Christianity, which should have also been the lens that they were looking at their actions through as Christians.
That brings us to a close of question time. Please show your thanks for our panel.